Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. This is Bill Redway and I'm bringing you the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday 16th of February 2019. The music you just heard is called Dream of White Horses. It's by The Fair Rain, a six-piece acoustic band headed by Robin Beattie, who is also the composer of this piece. Their music is a fusion of many styles, from jazz to folk to contemporary classical, with a touch of Middle Eastern rhythms. This track is to be found on their CD album, Behind the Glass. As usual, I'll play the track in full at the end of the programme. Now, we have an announcement about the AGM. We do hope you'll be able to come to our AGM this year. Your invitation is enclosed with this week's memory stick. The AGM is being held on Saturday, 27th of April, 2019, at 2:30 p.m. The venue is the same as last year, St Mary's Church, Sherwood Avenue, The Quadrant, St Albans. The meeting lasts about 45 minutes and is followed by a buffet and social, which gives you a chance to meet some friends and volunteers. We do hope you'll be able to come. Would you please complete the tear-off slip at the bottom of the invitation and return it to us in one of the pouches? Transport can be provided if you require it. And if there is any further information you want, please contact Sue Fennell on 01727 765 852. We look forward to seeing you on the 27th of April 2019. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the Hearts Advertiser, the edition published on the 14th of February, and we follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days, courtesy of Sue, once again. In part two, we have three articles from Hearts Life magazine. The first is about life on Mars. The second is a conversation with a cathedral guide, while the third is the story of the Rye House plot to kill Charles II in 1683. We start with the news, and our readers today are Gilly, Margaret, Dominic and Anne.
Hello, my name is Gilly, and I'm going to start with the Hearts Advertiser's readings for this week, and my piece is entitled Radio DJ Takes a Stand Over Colleague's Dismissal. A well-known Radio Verulam DJ will no longer host his long-standing weekday show amid a row over religious content. Danny Smith, who has hosted West Hearts Drive Time for almost 9 years, has made a stand in support of fellow presenter Elspeth Jackson. Elspeth has been embroiled in controversy over her Christian show Elspeth's Afternoon, which has aired every Sunday for 12 years. Bosses at the community station told her from now on she must not only speak about Christianity, but incorporate other faiths too. Section 4 of the Ofcom guidelines, entitled Religion, states that religious broadcasters must be responsible and not exploit any susceptibilities of the audience, be abusive, or seek recruits. After forwarding an email exchange about the issue to some of her church contacts as part of a request for prayers, Elspeth was told she was no longer welcome as a volunteer at the station. Now, Danny has thrown his backing behind Elspeth by withdrawing his services as a presenter until the situation is resolved. After a short conversation with Radio Verulam chairman Nick Hazel, Danny said he believes the station's directors are not changing their decision about Elspeth, and so he does not expect to return. He explained, "I am sad to think that I will no longer be serving this community that I love. I see it as a tremendous privilege to be broadcasting to this community. But I believe that St Albans deserves a first-class community radio station, and that Radio Verulam is no longer delivering that. I believe that the station has been moving away from the community for a few years. It wants to be a commercial station, and it seems that all community initiatives here are scaled back or got rid of in favour of things that make money. But the reality of a community station is not just to make money, but to serve the community. Danny is taking a stand after working about 10,000 unpaid hours volunteering for the station. He believes Radio Verulam wanted to stop Elspeth's Christian show because it is taking an anti-religious stance. A community station should reflect its community, and we do have a higher proportion of churches and churchgoers than other communities would have. Time and again, the station seems to think that this area is like any other, but the Brexit result only shows we are different and are unique. Elspeth is not the first person to be treated badly. Elspeth has forgiven Radio Verulam, wishing to move on. I feel it was a big injustice, but I will forgive them for it because that is what a Christian is, she added. Danny's actions amazed and humbled me. Danny sees much more of what goes on at Radio Verulam than I do, as he uses the studio there, and he has been more in touch with it than I have, and he has noticed the volunteers aren't being treated very well. Danny said, I felt shocked, in disbelief, and I felt really sad for Elspeth. I have stood by while long-term broadcasters have been treated badly for too long, and I've seen the station become managed more and more by people outside our community, and I don't think it is right. He predicts Radio Verulam will struggle to find a volunteer willing to give up 3 hours every weekday to replace him.
Hello, I'm Anne, and I'm reading about the neighbourhood plan vote in Harpenden. 90% of voters back neighbourhood plan. Harpenden residents have overwhelmingly voiced their approval for the town's neighbourhood plan, NP. In a referendum last Thursday, 4,490 people voted to approve the NP, a document which guides the town's housing, employment, infrastructure, transport and green space protection for the next 15 years. Almost 90% of people voted yes in the referendum, which saw a 22.4% turnout. Covering both Harpenden and Kinsbourne Green, the NP includes proposals to build a minimum of 23 affordable houses on the former Westfield allotment site, 14 homes each at Pan Auto Services and Dewson on Grove Road, and 34 homes at Harpenden Memorial Hospital. The South Down Industrial Estate is also protected as a key employment location. Community Representative Nicola Wyeth, who helped to draft the document, said, I'm absolutely delighted by the result of the NP referendum. It is a great success for Harpenden. I would really like to thank all the residents that engaged with the NP, helped get the message out across Harpenden and voted. A great success for our fabulous town. The NP was put together by a steering group made out of community representatives, Harpenden Town Council and Harpenden Rural Parish Council. The group used 3,625 survey responses in three rounds of community engagement to create the NP. Chair of the NP steering group, Councillor Brian Ellis, said, We are delighted that residents voted overwhelmingly in favour of adopting the Harpenden NP. The plan will help us shape future development in the town. It is a truly community-led document, prepared by local residents for local residents. Now the NP has been adopted, 25% of the community infrastructure levy from new developments in Harpenden will be spent in the town, and St Albans District Council are obliged to consider the document in all the area's planning applications.
Hello, my name is Dominic, and the first story that I have is coming with the headline, Building Work Finally Underway Ahead of New School's Opening. Building work is well underway at the new Catherine Warrington School in Harpenden, which is set to open later this year. After overcoming multiple planning hurdles, Harpenden's new secondary school is finally being built, with pupils admitted from September this year. The building work is split into three phases, the first of which is a sports centre, internally converted to classrooms for the first year intake in September. The second phase is a fully built school to accommodate 1,150 pupils with more than 65 classrooms, due to be completed by September 2020. The third phase, also due to complete in September next year, will see the sports centre converted back to its original purpose. Catherine Warrington is also in its initial stage of recruitment for teaching and support staff. So far, the school has recruited teachers to head the core subjects of English, maths and science, as well as hiring a special needs coordinator. Founding head teacher Tony Smith said, "All of the successful candidates are experienced teachers who have worked in schools in Hertfordshire for several years and lived in the county. The opportunity to lead a key department and contribute to the setup of a brand new school proved to be a fantastic opportunity that attracted a wide and extremely talented field. It was a delight to see the candidates teach classes at the three Harpenden secondary schools, face student panels, sit data tests, and complete two separate panel interviews. I am delighted with the appointments we have made." Ben Bardsley, chair of Harpenden Parents Group, said, "Parents in general, but especially those of current Year 6 children who are keen to join the school when it opens, are very relieved and excited to finally see work commencing and progress being made. It really brings home what a great opportunity the new school is for the town and villages, and we hope that construction goes smoothly towards the opening later this year. Pupils who have applied to join in September can meet their new teachers and get a taste of the school in an open day on Saturday, March the 2nd. Sessions run from 9:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Randwood Park School in Harpenden. And accompanying the story is a picture of what looks to be a building site with some groundworks being undertaken in the distance as they try and get the school ready.
Hello, this is Margaret, and my piece is about a strongman grudge match. The UK's Strongest Man held its launch event in St Albans City Centre on Saturday with a 250-kilogram deadlift challenge. The event saw Pa O'Dwyer, the winner of the UK's Strongest Man in 2018, take on England's strongman Sean Logan outside the Auburn Arena. O'Dwyer and Logan both achieved 32 lifts, but Logan threw in the towel on the 33rd, leaving O'Dwyer the victor. At 64 lifts between the two strongmen, they lifted the equivalent of 16 tonnes. Reflecting on his victory, O'Dwyer said, "It was great being back in St Albans, and Sean, who's a fantastic deadlifter, pushed me really hard. He's a real contender for the UK title this year. I was surprised we managed as many lifts as we did, but the great crowd really kept us going, and of course it was great to get a win for Ireland." The UK's Strongest Man is a three-day competition taking place from July the 26th to the 28th at the Abbey View Athletics Track in Verulamium Park.
Dangerous road junction will see safety measures for pedestrians. Zebra crossings are set to be introduced at a busy St Albans junction to make it safer for pedestrians. The King Harry Junction, which links King Harry Lane, Watling Street, Watford Road and St Stephen's Hill, will be getting two new zebra crossings, pedestrian safety improvements and a new road surface this month, following safety concerns about the current crossing points. The junction is a vital pedestrian route as well as an important route for traffic heading in and out of the city centre, but there have been concerns that the pavements are unsafe and there are not enough places to cross the road safely. The County Council's highways contractor, Ringway, will install the zebra crossings, replace kerbs, realign and resurface pavements and resurface the road itself. County Councillor Sandy Walkington said, For too long, pedestrians have been dicing with death when trying to cross Watling Street and Watford Road at the King Harry Junction. It has been particularly hazardous for less mobile elderly residents and parents struggling with buggies and toddlers as they walk to the nearby schools and playgroups. I am so pleased that my campaign to get these crossings installed has now borne fruit. The works will start on Monday, February the 18th, and are due to take 3 weeks to complete. The roads need to be completely closed while the work takes place, but they will be closed in phases to minimise disruption. St Stephen's Hill and Watling Street will be closed between February the 18th and February the 24th, and King Harry Lane and Watford Road will be closed between February the 25th and March the 3rd. After that, the resurfacing works will take place overnight between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m, so the roads will remain open in the daytime. Cabinet Member for Highways Phil Bibby said, "We want to make our road network safer for pedestrians and make it easier for people to get around on foot. We know these improvement works will be disruptive, and I'd like to apologise in advance for the inconvenience. I hope people will bear with us while we make these important safety improvements, as the end result will be a safer junction for everyone." There's a picture of Sandy Walkington at the King Harry Junction with some residents. And also there are details of road closures and diversion routes can be found at www.hertfordshire.gov.uk/roadworks.
This article is entitled A414 Improvement Proposals to Tackle 100,000 New Homes in Hertfordshire Before 2031. Proposals to revitalise the A414 through St Albans are now out for consultation. Hearts County Council's A414 corridor strategy includes 30 sets of proposals along the length of the road from Hemel Hempstead to Harlow, taking in Watford, St Albans, Welwyn Hatfield and Broxbourne along the way. For St Albans drivers, plans include improvements to walking and cycling routes, bike parking at the train station, bus services and junctions near Chiswell Green. The corridor strategy also proposes changes to the Peahen and London Road junction and a new bridge over the Abbey Flyer Line. Harts County Council, HCC, Cabinet Member for Growth, Infrastructure, Planning and the Economy, Derek Ashley, said, "There are up to 100,000 new homes planned for Hertfordshire by 2031, and 50% of these will be along the A414 route. This will have a significant impact on the road itself and on the towns along the route, and the increased traffic congestion will lead to longer journey times if we do nothing. The St Albans local plan alone is finding space for 15,000 new homes around the district by 2036. Councillor Ashley said, "We need to make improvements to this key cross-county road, but just as importantly, we need to make walking, cycling and public transport more attractive and practical options. This is the biggest period of growth for Hertfordshire since the post-Second World War new towns era. A key part of ensuring we deliver good growth will be to ensure that our communities are economically, socially and environmentally sustainable." He said they are particularly interested to hear from young people about their future travel. "To do this, we need people to make sustainable transport choices, and we need to have the supporting infrastructure and improvements in place along the A414 corridor. We want residents to tell us what they think about the A414 corridor strategy to help guide our future transport planning and investment. The consultation is open until February the 25th at hertfordshire.gov.uk /about the council. And you'll find it if you go on then to the A414 corridor summary of the consultation.
Thameslink, worst in UK for cancellations in 2018. Govia Thameslink had more cancellations last year than any other train company in the UK, according to recent statistics. The Office of Rail and Road released statistics which show that 23,000 GTR trains were cancelled in the first quarter of 2018-2019 out of nearly 299,000 planned services. In the second quarter of 2018-2019, 23,000 GTR trains were also cancelled out of nearly 318,000 services. The quarters follow the financial year, so the first quarter is from April 1st to June 30th, and the second is for the 3 months following that. The train company with the second highest number of cancelled services was Northern, with 11,000 trains cancelled out of more than 213,000 planned for the first quarter of 2018-19, and with 8,315 out of just over 220,000 cancelled in the second quarter. The most reliable train service in the country was a Caledonian Sleeper, with 10 trains cancelled in the first quarter and 18 in the second. Thameslink introduced a new timetable on May the 20th last year, which led to widespread delays and cancellations, largely due to staff shortages as train crews adjusted to the changes. An interim timetable was introduced on Sunday, July the 15th, to try and address the issues, which saw a slight improvement in services. The Monday following the interim timetable's introduction, 55.9% of Thameslink trains arrived at their scheduled time, compared to 46.6% of trains between May the 27th and June the 23rd. A GTR spokesman said, "The proportion of services cancelled because of train crew issues peaked sharply immediately after last May's timetable changes at almost 5%. This was because, given extremely short notice, we were unable to match our drivers' route knowledge and home depots to all of the new service patterns required. This was reduced quickly by introducing the interim timetable in July and has fallen steadily since to the previous year's level of around 1% or less, with 400 more daily services now running. Thanks to the UK's largest ever recruitment and training programme, we now have over 2,000 qualified drivers and a further 300 in training, more than enough for our fleet of 535 trains in normal circumstances."
This next piece is headed, "Shocked Driver Pays a £60 Parking Fine Despite Proof of Inputting Mix-Up." A frustrated driver has spoken out about automated parking systems issuing unfair, in inverted commas, tickets at St Albans City Station. Sally Cartwright and her husband were going into London one evening, parking in St Albans City Station car park and paying for the right date and time period with her card. A couple of weeks later, she was shocked to receive a £100 parking fine in the post, reduced to £60 if paid in 14 days. It read, "The bylaws were made under Section 219 of the Transport Act 2000, as amended under the Railways Act 2005, and an offence has been committed by breaching bylaw 14. Having identified that an offence has occurred, your data has been released by the Driver and Vehicle Licensing Agency, as our client has reasonable cause under the Road Vehicles Registration and Licensing Regulations 2002. Calling the appeals number listed, she was told her registration plate was inputted incorrectly, and despite having proof of payment on her back statement, the fine still stands. She said, "I would never dream of not paying for a parking ticket, and I did buy a ticket. Maybe there was something wrong with the number plate, but it doesn't mean I didn't pay. It was quite an aggressive letter, and they were so unhelpful, saying, 'If you appeal it, the fine will be more. You will have to pay £100 and there will be no way back.' Seeing as Sally's car number plate is similar to her husband's, she believes it was a simple mix-up. Worried by the legal threats in the letter, however, Sally reluctantly paid the fine, plus a handling fee. She said, 'I was really upset and stressed at the audacity of it, that they can get away with it.' Sally was shocked to discover a number of people recounting the same ordeal on a Facebook group called All About St Albans. A lot of people haven't paid it, but I was too nervous to do that, and I think that's what happens. A lot of people are so frightened by it they pay, and so they're going to keep getting away with it. I will never park in that car park again. I will walk in the rain if I have to. A GTR spokesman said, "Our parking contractor advises customers who believe they have been issued with a penalty notice wrongly to make a formal appeal in order to avoid the penalty being increased. If the customer can show through the appeal process that they did pay the correct parking charge, the notice will be withdrawn."
Now, a driver who refused to take a wheelchair user has his licence revoked after he pleaded guilty. A taxi driver who refused to pick up a blind man and a wheelchair user from St Albans city centre has had his licence revoked. Last July, former president of St Albans Chamber of Commerce, David Clark, who is blind, and former Harpenden Town Councillor, Michael Weaver, who uses a wheelchair, were dining with the Chamber's Executive Director, Lisa Bates Wallace. Lisa called and paid ahead for a taxi to take them from George Street to Harpenden, but when the Gold Line taxi driver pulled up, he was not parallel with Michael's wheelchair. When asked to move forward, the driver told Miss Bates Wallace that he had a bad back, adding, "I'm not dealing with this," before driving away. The group was left stunned and disgusted at the driver's behaviour. St Albans Magistrates Court heard on February the 6th. Gold Line apologised after the incident and sent another car to take the booking. Majid Hussein Butt of Ash Road in Luton pleaded guilty to failure to comply with Section 165 of the Equality Act 2010. He was fined £250 along with a victim surcharge of £30 and ordered to pay a contribution towards St Albans District Council's costs of £250. His Hackney carriage driver's licence has also been revoked, although he has 3 weeks to appeal that decision. In mitigation, Butt solicitor Ahmed Malik said his client had worked as a taxi driver for 6 years without complaint. Chair of St Albans District Council, SADC, Licensing and Regulatory Committee, Councillor David Heritage, said, "We are very sorry at the distress caused by the refusal of one of our licensed taxi drivers to take a wheelchair user. The driver's action has led to both a successful prosecution by the council in the courts and the decision to take away his licence under our convictions policy. Under the Equality Act, licensed taxi drivers using accessible vehicles must not discriminate against wheelchair users. They should also give them assistance when required. The vast majority of our taxi drivers do an excellent job and are very helpful to disabled customers, with complaints being very rare. However, this prosecution shows that when we are told of an offence, we will investigate and take appropriate action."
This article is the opinion article from Hearts Advertiser this week. "It all seems to be a massive farce," in quotes. A view from Europe on the Brexit crisis. Eleanor Vickery is a 21-year-old university student from Harpenden who is currently on a year abroad in Vienna, working at the United Nations. Here she gives her opinion on Brexit from the perspective of a British citizen living and working in the heart of Europe. "Being European as well as British is an intrinsic part of my identity, and I would like to think that I am not alone in the values I identify with: multiculturalism, tolerance, openness. Our rights as EU citizens to work and live in Europe have benefited me massively. I am lucky enough to work for one of the world's biggest organisations, have been exposed to people of all different nationalities and backgrounds, and gained skills that will most definitely help me career-wise later in life. Living abroad has pushed me out of my comfort zone and made me rethink my preconceptions about the world. I now speak almost fluent German, an important skill to have in a country where fewer students are taking language A levels each year, and the wide-held view seems to be, what's the point? They all speak English anyway. This is a dangerous view to have, may I add, both in terms of the inward-looking political perspective it fosters and the negative impact of our foreign language deficit on the economy. Sitting on my balcony in Vienna, I like to pretend that Brexit isn't happening, that I will be able to stay here doing my internship, and that everything will be fine. But the reality is that after March the 29th, no one knows what will happen. My colleagues at work, from a myriad of places such as France, Guinea-Bissau, Palestine, and Brazil, to name just a few, observe Brexit with bemusement and confused despair. When I first joined at the start of January, they would ask where I was from and then joke about Brexit. It all just seems to be a massive farce, said a fellow intern from Germany to me the other day, regarding current Parliament's current chaotic to-ing and fro-ing over Brexit. They are just as worried about the current right-leaning trends in global politics, but for now they are privileged enough to view Brexit from a distance and as a joke. But for those of us affected by Brexit, namely everyone in our country, it isn't a joke. Politicians will be letting the people down if they continue down this slippery slope to a no deal. They have a chance now to drag the country out of this mess and give the power back to the people. They won't do so because they are more preoccupied with pride and party politics than their constituents' well-being. They say they are honouring democracy by sticking to the result of the referendum. In reality, they are being wholly undemocratic. It has since emerged that the vote was based on lies and electoral fraud, and that a very small minority of the population support Theresa May's deal. The way I see it, Theresa May is scaremongering her way towards either her pathetic deal or a catastrophic no deal. She will carry on regardless and has no regard for popular opinion. As constituents of an area that will undeniably suffer from Brexit, due to our reliance on London for work, in brackets, the area of the UK that will in real monetary terms lose the most from Brexit, close brackets, we must continue letting our politicians know that their approach to Brexit, namely burying their heads in the sand for the sake of their own political careers, is not one we will accept. Without a people's vote, we are denying future generations the opportunities that we ourselves gain from being in the EU. Had I been a year younger, I might not have been able to come to Austria to do my potentially career-changing internship. We are also resigning ourselves to the fact that no matter what Brexit deal we have, it will make us poorer. And no deal could result in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Most Europeans I have encountered here view Brexit as crazy. I would say that is a fair observation. It is all very well going on thinking that nothing will change in 2 months' time, but when your flights to Europe are cancelled, prices of fresh food go through the roof, the M20 is stacked up past Maidstone, and you can't get your prescription medicines, that nothing will seem like quite a lot. So now is the time to do something. Write to Bim Afalami and Anne Main. Get in touch with St Albans and Harpenden for Europe. Go to a demonstration. We absolutely cannot sit back and bury our hands in the sand too. And this article is accompanied by a photo of the UN building in Vienna and Eleanor herself standing in the street of Vienna with a tram behind her.
This article is the latest from Becky Alexander, and it has the headline Clothes and Coffee. The indie coffee shop craze hasn't quite swept Harpenden in the same way it has in St Albans. Costa and Cafe Nero seem to have quite a stronghold. But I'd like to tell you about a new coffee shop that, unless you're out shopping for men's clothes, you might have missed. 8 Ounces opened in November as part of Purple Menswear, which is just up near Godfrey's Fish and Chip Shop. It's owned by Paul Monks. It's a stylish shop that sells designer menswear at the front, including a range by David Beckham, and has a Menspire barbershop at the back. The coffee shop is in the middle and has seating for about 10 people, more when the weather is good, because it has a great little secret garden area. Paul won Young Entrepreneur of the Year in a local business awards last year and has been featured in Drapers. His sense of style is evident in the coffee shop. It is a bright room with funky green banquettes and a large vintage-style mirror which makes the most of the space. They sell Campbell and Syme coffee, which is roasted and ground in King's Langley. My partner's flat white was perfect. It is the same coffee that Hatch sell and Fred and Ginger in Berkhamsted. Paul told me that they serve glasses of tap water with coffee too, in the Italian style. Becky says she chose a Moroccan mint tea, which was by Brew Co. Tea. It had a good flavour, but needed to be served in a small teapot, which is usual for that brand. Then you can get 2 cups out of it. The coffee and tea prices are good, with most at the £2 to £2.70 mark, which is similar to the chain coffee shops. I like the smart coffee cup branding. There is a small range of pressed juices too, and I was intrigued by the charcoal lemonade, which contains lemon, lavender and activated charcoal. The cakes were mostly chocolate-based, which isn't a problem for me. You could choose millionaire shortbread, fridge cake, cornflake cake or Italian-filled twists. Something gluten-free or lemony would be a good option. I was pleased to see that they are supplying paper straws and napkins made from recycled paper. The bathroom needs a good clean, but hey, this is Harpenden, and people are going to notice. A useful addition to Harpenden High Street that supports local suppliers, this is the way to keep shoppers visiting small indie retail spaces as we shop more and more online, making it a lifestyle space to visit often, whether you want to buy a gift, get a whole new spring wardrobe, or just pop in for coffee. A clever idea.
This next piece is about a radio producer capturing lives on audio for posterity. A Redbone radio producer has captured the attention of the nation by immortalising the unique life stories of local residents. Despite only setting up Record Them in August last year, Dave Creasy has been bombarded by requests for his unique service from customers across the country. He interviews people about their life stories and edits the sound clips into a professional audio documentary to be played and replayed as a memento of loved ones after they pass. The 27-year-old said, "Normally radio stations only do this sort of thing when it's a celebrity, not for ordinary people, and it's something I wanted for everybody rather than just people who are rich and famous." Interviews take a maximum of 4 hours with breaks to create a documentary of about an hour. He pointed out that in about 15 years' time, no one who remembers the Second World War will still be alive. The oldest person Dave has recorded so far was a 91-year-old. However, he's scheduled to meet with a 100-year-old woman soon. He said it was much more than an audio clip. "We really jazz it up with sound effects and music. People keep pictures and albums, but the first thing they forget is the sound of their voice. Nobody thinks to record their loved ones." Dave also offers an option for previously unheard messages from their loved ones to be kept back and delivered on special occasions each year, such as birthdays or Christmas. After being featured in The Times in December and winning Theo Paphaitis' Small Business Sunday Award in January, Dave is now booked up until April. The service costs about £500. However, Dave said a similar video documentary service will set consumers back a whopping £10,000. Dave has worked in 4 radio stations over 6 years, including the BBC and Forces Radio stationed in Cyprus. He said his favourite part of Record Them is people's shock to hear the finished product. They don't know that they want it until they hear it. Dave described it as a keepsake like no other.
This next article says, "Move aside, mystery machine, because a horticulture van is set to bring gardening to isolated people. A green-fingered charity is setting off to visit gardens around St Albans in their new touring horticulture vehicle. At a shindig at its headquarters, Earthworks revealed a new branded van which will be used to transport gardeners to the houses of vulnerable people in St Albans. Once there, those on the Earthworks on Wheels project will lend a hand to sprucing up the person's rundown garden. During the pilot, Earthworks on Wheels will tour once a week, but in time the charity hope to run it 5 days a week. The van can carry 6 people, meaning there is space for workers of all abilities to be adequately assisted by support staff. Joint project leader Steve Pike said, "It really does make a big difference to us. We have been going out 1 day a week into the community to do gardening work for vulnerable people, particularly older people. So it has got a dual benefit. It's a great work experience for our guys. I'm sure they will tell you they are all tremendously proud to go out and do a day's work. It fills them with satisfaction and we have a great time doing it. And we are visiting people who might be a bit more isolated or definitely need a bit of help with their gardens. We are helping to get their gardens back, but we are also quite a friendly bunch, so we will sit and have a cup of tea, which is sometimes all they want." He said getting out and showing the community what we can do was an important part of the project. It has been funded by Coney Heath Parish Council, Robbins and Day, the Rotary Club of St Albans, Verulamium, and North Pole trekker Ed Sutty. Ed raised £60,000 for 3 local charities in 2016, one of which was Earthworks. About £14,000 of that went towards the Earthworks on Wheels project. He said, "The power and recuperation of horticultural practices, both for the earthworkers and volunteers, is a very powerful thing, and I was really keen to support that and take them on the next leg of their evolution." Earthworks are situated on a 3-acre site on Hicksbury Lane, complete with gardens, heritage orchard, vegetable beds, shade tunnels and polytunnel. The charity offers horticultural training for people with learning disabilities, and you can find out more at earthworksstalbans.co.uk, and there's a lovely picture of all those on the Earthworks on Wheels project.
The corks will be popping and the fizz will be flowing when St Albans welcomes back the UK's biggest Prosecco Festival later this year. The event at the Auburn Arena on May the 31st and June the 1st features more than 30 different types of Prosecco, Spumante, Brut, Cava, Pink Fizz and Prosecco cocktails, plus an array of gins from around the world. The festival includes an array of Italian street food designed to complement the fizz, and a stage with a live band performing. All bars work on a token system, which can be purchased using cash or card from points at the venue. Tokens are priced £5 each and can be exchanged for any drink. Standard entry is from £12.50 and includes festival access, a branded Prosecco festival flute, and complimentary Prosecco wristband, live entertainment and access to the Italian street food stand. And you can purchase your tickets online at proseccofestival.co.uk. And the article is accompanied by 2 flutes of Prosecco, one a very pale yellow and the other a pink one.
Now, details of 2 forthcoming concerts. A folk concert cancelled due to the weather has been rearranged for this weekend in St Albans. duo Alison Frosdick and Jack Burnaby, plus support from solo singer Blanid and Watford-based group Turn Rest, were due to perform at Folk at the Maltings in St Albans on February the 1st. However, the concert was cancelled because of bad weather. The performers can now be heard on Sunday, February the 17th from 7:30pm at the Robin Hood Pub in Victoria Street. Growing up in Somerset and Hampshire, Alison Frosdick and Jack Burnaby are well rooted in the folk music of England. Their singing is usually accompanied by Jack's squeeze boxes and Alison's whistle. But on their new highly acclaimed CD, Adzooks, they have introduced more textures including cello, piano and guitar. New Roots 2017 finalist Blathnaid McCulloch now sings under the name of Blanid. Admission is free, but a collection will be taken. And details of a lunchtime recital. It's the turn of Tanza Ensemble to provide the lunchtime music at a St Albans City Centre church. They will perform at St Peter's Church on Wednesday, February the 20th. The ensemble features Julian Cable on piano, Maria Thomas on oboe, flautist Peter Wakefield and baritone Jim Wills. Their programme features works by Telemann, Debussy, Britten, Gluck and Schubert. The Tanza Ensemble previously performed their St Peter's programme at a lunchtime recital at the Guild Church of St Martin's within Ludgate, City of London, in October 2018 and at Burr House, Hampstead, last month. Oboist Maria Thomas plays regularly in several amateur chamber ensembles and orchestras, alongside running her business, the Music Workshop Company, and working as programme leader for the BA Honours Music Industry Management degree at the University of Hertfordshire. The recital starts at 1pm with donations in aid of Rennie Grove Hospice Care.
This next piece is about Wheat Hampstead Dramatic Society. A romantic drama will bring a taste of Italy to Wheat Hampstead next week. Wheat Hampstead Dramatic Society's next production is That Good Night by N.J. Crisp. Opening at the Memorial Hall in Marford Road on Thursday, February the 21st, the play is set in a beautiful villa in the Italian countryside near Rome. The five characters are Ralph, a man in his 70s coming to term with illness, his devoted younger wife Anna, Michael, his long-abandoned son from a previous relationship, Michael's girlfriend Debbie, and a mysterious visitor. It's a story about family relationships, love and forgiveness, as well as the surprises that unfold when Ralph acts on secret thoughts to protect his loved one. The play premiered in 1996 with Donald Sinden playing the lead and receiving ecstatic reviews. That Good Night was recently made into an acclaimed film featuring the last screen performance of the actor Sir John Hurt. WDS performances run from February 21st to Saturday the 23rd at 8pm. Tickets cost £10 and are available from Manor Pharmacy in Wheat Hampstead or online at wheathampsteaddramaticsociety.co.uk, and there's a picture of three of the cast.
And now for the Talking Newspaper radio listings from the 16th of February to Friday the 22nd of February. For Saturday the 16th of February, BBC Three is devoting all of its daytime programmes over the entire weekend to celebrating the music of Hector Berlioz, the French romantic composer, on the 150th anniversary of his death. The BBC orchestras and choirs mark this occasion with programmes capturing his colourful life and innovative music. A new series of the afternoon drama on Radio 4 is Chinatowns, a radical reinterpretation of six Five Towns novels by Arnold Bennett, 1867 to 1931. An epic tale of money, passion and defiance, set in the Staffordshire Potteries and following the inhabitants of Bursley and the Five Towns of Stoke-on-Trent between 1865 and 1903. The series of 11 hourly episodes is being broadcast each weekend on Saturday at 2:30pm and on Sunday at 3 p.m. Neil Dudgeon and Tim McInerney lead a strong cast. On Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m, Hilarious Histories, What's So Funny About the Past, is a compilation of programmes that portray historical characters and sometimes awful events with humour. Examples are Blackadder Goes Forth and Monty Python's The Life of Brian. Stephen Fry and other contributors also add their thoughts. For Sunday the 17th of February, on Radio 4, at 11:15 a.m, Lauren Laverne's guest castaway on Desert Island Discs is the crime writer Anne Cleves. At 1:30 p.m. on Radio 4, Miss Michelle Hussein presents From Our Home Correspondent, the monthly series featuring dispatches from journalists and writers across the UK. On Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m, in a new series of Poetry Please, former National Poet of Wales Gillian Clark chooses from the Poetry Please database of listeners' requests.
A look now at programmes that run each day through the week from Monday to Friday. At 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 FM, the book of the week is Je T'aime, the legendary love story of Jane Birkin and Serge Gainsborough. Le Monde journalist Véronique Mortain has interviewed friends, family and colleagues of the iconic couple to tell the story of their tempestuous relationship during the 1960s and 70s. On Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m. and repeated at 7:45 p.m, the 15-minute drama is Curious Under the Stars, Devil's Bridge. The comedy drama by Anna Maria Murphy is about Gareth and Diane, pub landlords in Glan Don, a mysterious village perched on the wild Welsh coast. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at midday is Johann Sebastian Bach, 1685 to 1750. At 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4, Ladder to Nowhere is the story of Lisa Ward, who tells how she eventually escaped from a life blighted by a web of gang culture in 1990s Manchester, and meets former gang members who are now trying to reverse a new explosion of street violence. The Full Works concerts with Jane Jones on Classic FM at 8 p.m. have a great selection of composers this week, beginning with Carl Jenkins, and then Fauré, Haydn, Tchaikovsky, and finally Elgar.
Here are some picks for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday the 18th of February at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, The Placebo Paradox discusses how the placebo process could be used as a therapy by using the body's biology to treat conditions with no side effects and little cost. Neurologist Ash Ranpura explores the cutting-edge science unlocking the mechanisms that underpin the placebo effect and could possibly reduce the addiction to opioid pain-killing drugs. On Tuesday the 19th of February, on Radio 4 at 11 p.m, Crash Course is a new panel game where teams have 24 hours to cram as much knowledge as they can on a given subject. Host David Tyler is joined by guests Marcus Brigstock, Josie Lawrence, Mark Watson and Kirsty Walk. It should be great fun. On Wednesday the 20th, on Radio 4 at 11 a.m, Dangerous Crossings investigates what makes parents risk their own lives and the lives of their children as they embark on dangerous journeys across the English Channel in tiny dinghies. Interviews are not only with the parents, but also with the smugglers. At 7:30 p.m, Radio 3 in Concert is last Friday's concert from The Sage in Gateshead. Presented by Mark Forrest, this is a rare chance to hear the second of the mighty Brahms piano concertos, with Lars Vogt directing the Royal Northern Sinfonia from the keyboard.
And on Thursday the 21st of February, the film programme is on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. And Antonia Quirk is joined by Larushka Ivanzadeh as they embark on a pilgrimage to the house in Dungeness, Kent, of filmmaker Derek Jarman, who died in 1994, aged 52. To mark this 25th anniversary, they also hear from colleagues who worked on his films, which included Caravaggio, The Last of England and Edward II. At 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, Mark Steele's in town, and for the sixth and final episode in this series, the comedian travels a little further afield than usual as he visits the Mediterranean island of Malta. The live audience of Maltese residents seem to love his jokes about national quirks and obsessions. And on Friday the 22nd of February at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, The Opportunity of Divorce explores the unexpected consequence of increased divorce rates within immigrant communities. The journalist Kieran Yates travels to Sweden, where many women from refugee communities and who come from a very patriarchal upbringing seek to divorce their husbands once they are settled. Sweden has a higher percentage of women in work than anywhere else in Europe, and female refugees are supported into employment, which may disrupt the status quo at home. At 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis present a new series of The Now Show, with a satirical look through the week's news and contributions from guest comedians. Radio 3 in Concert at 7:30 p.m. is a live concert from the Barbican Hall in London. The BBC Symphony Orchestra will play Mozart's Symphony No. 35 in D, Thomas Latcher's Nocturne Insomnia, and Das Lied von der Erde by Mahler. In complete contrast, on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. is Friday Night is Music Night, and singer Beverly Knight performs the greatest hits of Motown superstar Stevie Wonder in a concert recorded last November at the London Palladium.
Here are the names of people and their ages, if published, who have died recently and whose names are recorded in the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser. We hope they rest in peace and send condolences to their families. Gillian Balance, aged 89. Raymond John Blake, aged 71. Sylvia Brooker, 93. Dorothy May Winch, 94. Glenn Shorey, aged 25. Peter Holmes. Nora King, aged 83. Susan Ann Knott. Marlene Fox. Mary Ann Fitzgerald, aged 85. Bob Bradbury, aged 70. And Daphne Margaret Munt, age 92.
Hello, I'm Terry, and my article is called Life on Mars. The launch of Europe's first rover to Mars is 2 years and counting. The engineers at the Stevenage site building are putting it through its final paces so that it can search for life. Mars has played on the imagination for centuries. From the Romans' God of War to the invading B-movie Martians of the 1950s, the Red Planet has exerted a powerful fascination. Now Hertfordshire is to play a key role in exploring the planet, and the countdown has begun. Europe's first Mars rover, which is being built in Stevenage, is scheduled to take off from Russia in 2 years' time and land on Mars in 2021. It aims to answer one of the major scientific questions of our time. Has life existed, or still exists, on Mars? A prototype of the ExoMars rover has begun a demanding test campaign to ensure that it can survive the rigours of launch and landing, as well as operations under the environmental conditions of Mars. ExoMars is a joint endeavour between the European Space Agency and Russia's Roscosmos, and the rover, being built at the Stevenage Airbus Defence and Space Centre, will be the first of its kind to drill up to 2 metres below the surface and determine if evidence of life lies buried. A.B. Hutty, senior spacecraft structures engineer, explains. Our mission has a primary objective of finding life on Mars. We know enough about the surface to know it's too hostile for life to survive there because of all the radiation that's constantly bombarding it. We need to look below the surface. If there is any life still on Mars, that's where we think it would still survive. Or, if we're looking at past life, we might be able to find remnants of that life at that depth. The six-wheeled solar-powered vehicle will use panoramic and close-up cameras and will drill for rock samples at various depths. Its structure, as well as its electrical and thermal components and the interfaces with its scientific instruments, have to be tested to check that they can survive the journey through space and operations at its destination. A structural and thermal model of the rover was therefore recently transferred from Gunnell's Wood Road to the Airbus site in Toulouse, France, where it's being shaken on a vibration table to ensure it can survive the intense juddering at rocket launch. The model will also be subjected to the shocks associated with entering another planet's atmosphere at high speed and, as parachutes opened, and finally, touchdown on Mars' surface. There will be 2 months of tests under Mars' atmospheric conditions to ensure it can withstand the huge daily temperature shifts, as well as storms and radiation. Some of the biggest challenges on Mars relate to the temperature, Abby explains. It's really very cold. At night it can get down to minus 130 degrees centigrade. Everything in terms of the materials is very brittle at those low temperatures, so any impacts are much more damaging than they would be at warmer temperatures. On Mars, it can shift 100 degrees centigrade from day to night. That means all the different materials are contracting and expanding due to those temperature changes, but at different rates. And that means they're trying to tear themselves apart from the other structural components. She adds that sand getting into mechanisms is a real issue, as well as dust storms. Not only can you not see where you're going, but it will be blocking the light to our solar panels and getting into places we don't want it. The surface of Mars is also heavily irradiated, so we have to think about the damaging effect on software systems which are on board. The tests in France will be conducted in a chamber to simulate the low atmospheric pressure of Mars and its carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere. A closed compartment inside the rover, where Martian soil samples will be analysed, will be thermally controlled to maintain temperatures between 20 centigrade and minus 40 centigrade. A Mars Yard, designed to mimic the surface and terrain of Mars, was established at Airbus in Stevenage in 2014 to put rover models through their paces. We use it to develop the locomotion systems and navigation systems on the rover, Abby explains. How it drives and also how it looks ahead of itself and decides where it needs to go. We've got sand here that's been specially dried in a kiln so it doesn't stick together. The surface of Mars is very dry and powdery. The rover will have an unmatched capability to autonomously navigate up to 70 metres a day with no outside guidance from ground control. Abby says, it can take 24 minutes for a signal to get from the Earth to Mars. With autonomous navigation, the rover can look at what's ahead of it and pick its own safe path through and navigate to its final destination. The launch to Mars is due in summer 2020 and the rover is scheduled to land there in January 2021. The completed rover will be shipped from Stevenage next summer for testing and further work before it is integrated into the rocket and descent module in Russia that will deliver it to the alien planet. More than 40 missions have been dispatched to Mars since the early 1960s, but the first fully successful touchdowns had to wait until the arrival of the US Viking 1 in July 1976, followed by Viking 2 in September the same year. Since then, there have been 5 more successful landings on the Red Planet, all by US spacecraft, as well as a number of failed attempts. As part of the ExoMars project, the Trace Gas Orbiter was launched into space in 2016 and is now orbiting Mars, looking for atmospheric gases that may be linked to active geological or biological processes. It will play a key role, relaying the rover's data back to Earth, a capability already demonstrated with communication relays to NASA's rovers currently on Mars. The ExoMars Schiaparelli module, which was designed to demonstrate entry, descent and landing technologies on Mars, separated from the Trace Gas Orbiter in October 2016 as planned, but crash-landed on the Red Planet due to conflicting information in the onboard computer, causing the descent sequence to end prematurely. The current test campaign for the rover is expected to last until the beginning of this month, when the rover module will then move to Levochkin in Moscow. Here, it will be sealed inside a replica descent module and again subjected to vibration, shock and thermal tests. Pietro Baglioni, the European Space Agency's ExoMars rover team leader, says, "This campaign kicks off a series of tests that will verify the mechanical and thermal design of the ExoMars rover, essential preparation that brings us a step closer to roving on the Red Planet." Another test model will soon start an 8-month-long campaign focusing on the rover's movements and navigation over a variety of different ground types, ranging from fine-grained soil to larger boulders. ExoMars marks a new era for European space exploration, advancing from remote observation to a landing on the surface of Mars. Hertfordshire is at the forefront of that, and its robot could make one of the biggest discoveries in human history. There are several photographs and pictures accompanying this article. The one that drew my attention was a group of young pupils from Roebuck Primary School in Stevenage observing the technology at the Airbus Foundation Discovery Space Centre in Stevenage, and another of a rover named Brian tackling a mock-up of the Mars surface in the Airbus Mars yard. Very, very exciting it looks as well.
Hello, I'm Deborah. This article is in the 5 Minutes With series. St Albans Cathedral welcomes around 200,000 people each year and plays a key role in the colourful spectacle of the Alban pilgrimage. City resident and cathedral guide Marissa Laycock tells us what she loves about her job. What's your favourite part of the cathedral? The Lady Chapel. When I attend a morning Eucharist, I connect to an inner sense of peace. It's very quiet, and the way the light diffuses into the sacred space through the stained glass window is quite beautiful. What surprised you about the building? I didn't realise that the medieval wall paintings in the cathedral are actually the most extensive collection in the UK. Also, during the dissolution of the monasteries, the medieval shrine of St Alban was destroyed. The restorers managed to fit 2,000 pieces of rubble back together. Amazing. There's a lot going on at the cathedral. What do you recommend? The concerts of famous composers like Bach and Mozart are pretty impressive as the sound travels up to the ceiling. The Adult Learning Centre holds many interesting talks from psychotherapy to Leonardo da Vinci and religion. But first-time visitors should go on a free guided tour. You can then understand the background and subtlety of the incredible architecture and artwork. What do you love about the job? I work alongside an interesting bunch of colleagues, from clergy to vergers and office staff, all with different interests and backgrounds. 2 of the volunteers are in their mid-90s. It's amazing to think that they've been volunteering here for about 30 years, since I was a teenager. I love watching children's faces as they look up to the ceiling. They seem totally overwhelmed, and I enjoy the conversations with tourists and listening to what part of the cathedral has sparked their interest, and often get the chance to practice my Italian and Spanish. Sometimes I might be doing something mundane, like cashing up. The next thing I can hear our choir singing evensong and feel as if I've gone to heaven. Tell us about the Alban Pilgrimage. The Alban Pilgrimage is where we remember the story of St. Alban. It's an exciting day. A huge procession takes place in the city, starting at St. Peter's Church and ending in the cathedral. Various stops are made enacting Alban's martyrdom using giant carnival puppets. Parishes from all over the diocese join us in our celebrations.
Hi, my name's Nick, and this article is entitled The Rye House Plot. Treason, regicide, religion and power all intertwine in a plot to kill a king and his brother at the gates of a Hertfordshire manor house in 1683. The assassination of a king and his brother, that's what they were about. Men of high rank plotted and schemed, flitted in the shadows and made their plans against the two leading men of the kingdom. It all happened 335 years ago, and at its heart was a house in Hertfordshire. The two men in the firing line were King Charles II and his younger brother, the Duke of York, the future James II. The scheme to dispose of them is known as the Rye House Plot, after a property near Hoddesdon. Rye House was built in the mid-15th century on the east bank of the Lee by Sir Andrew Ogard, a Danish knight, and was one of the first brick-built houses in the country. It was at a strategic location for an attack. The scheme was simple enough. The King and Duke would be heading back from Newmarket races to London and would pass Rye House. There was a narrow road nearby, down which the royal party would have to travel. It would be straightforward enough to ambush and kill them right there. What was this cause? One theory has it the conspirators were anti-papists, determined to remove a king who was leaning too much to Rome. England had been officially Protestant, with one brief interruption since Henry VIII. Not only that, but Charles II was not disposed, as many wanted, to set aside his younger brother, who was even more strident in his adherence to Catholicism. Republicanism was also a factor. The ex-Cromwellian plotters looked back to the period between 1649 and 1660, when England had no king after the Parliamentarians' overthrow and beheading of Charles and James's father, Charles I. Party politics also featured, with several prominent Whigs implicated. These identified very closely with the Protestant succession. One of the alleged plotters, Richard Rumbold, was the owner of Rye House. It would seem luck was on the royal side, however. The pair's early departure from horse racing, following a fire at the King's Newmarket estate, foiled the conspirators, who it was alleged were working to a precise timetable. However, some accounts claim their plans were not yet finalised. Whatever the case, the ambush never happened, but the story didn't end there. The failed plot was discovered in June 1683. The conspirators had relied on luck and utmost secrecy. They had neither. Allegations were made that prompted a government investigation. Arrests followed. The plotters, described by some as a death or glory brigade, were accused of scheming the death of the king at the house of a wine merchant and at each other's homes, presumably trying to cover their tracks by not meeting in the same place. They were charged with treason. The most famous of the conspirators was the illegitimate son of the king and nephew to James. The Duke of Monmouth, James Scott, escaped the law by fleeing the country. Some say he was allowed to because of his royal blood. Rumours had abounded, from 1662, that Monmouth would be legitimised and made heir to the throne in preference to the Duke of York. An energetic military commander and popular Protestant alternative, he was ambitious, yet reckless. The person who may have enmeshed him in the conspiracy was the first Earl of Shaftesbury Anthony Ashley Cooper, who also left the country before the plot was discovered. Another accused, Arthur Capel, Earl of Essex, was taken to the Tower of London, where he died, possibly a suicide. The politicians Lord William Russell, Algernon Sidney, who had fought for Parliament in the Civil War, and Sir Thomas Armstrong were convicted of treason and beheaded. Elizabeth Gaunt, accused of harbouring and maintaining rebels, was burnt at the stake. Others, including the Duke of Monmouth, Robert Ferguson, and Lord William Howard, escaped punishment. Monmouth's end was nigh, though. When Charles II died in February 1685, bringing his younger brother to the throne, he returned to Britain with an army to launch his Monmouth Rebellion, May to July 1685. Also known as the Pitchfork Rebellion, it was a failure, and Monmouth faced the axe. Rye House's Rumbold was executed for his participation in the same enterprise. He was involved in the Scottish arm of a two-pronged attack on the new king. Rye House was not just the backdrop to a royal murder attempt. It had a more picturesque side, its impressive gatehouse presenting a sufficiently attractive vista to be painted in watercolour and graphite by J.M.W. Turner in around 1793. In 1870, then-owner William Henry Teale opened a pleasure garden on the site and also displayed the Great Bed of Ware, mentioned by Shakespeare. It was such a popular tourist destination that an extra railway station was built to cope with the visitors. By the early 20th century, tourism had fallen away and the manor house was demolished. The Great Bed of Ware was shipped off to the Victoria and Albert Museum. What remains of Rye House today is just the gatehouse, with its diaper brickwork, oriel windows and barley sugar twist chimney. One intriguing footnote to the royal assassination plot is that some historians believe the whole thing was a fiction, made up by the royalist camp to discredit the opposition. That would have been a far more cunning plot. Charles II, buoyed up by the failure of the Rye House plotters, and with no legitimate heirs, was able to be even more trenchant in upholding his brother's right to succeed him. If walls could talk, we might learn the truth of this murky and twisting tale. But then the walls of Rye House are all but gone. The restored gatehouse, a silent sentinel to the past. And at the beginning of the article, there's a wonderful painting of Charles II. He is pictured sitting in his throne, looking suitably majestic, dressed in ermine, with a marvellously ornate crown on his head.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Jilly, Margaret, Dominic and Anne. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme. But that's all from me, Bill Redway, in February 2019. We close with the Fair Rain and their piece, Dream of White Horses. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.